And thanks for joining us. I'm Keith Shortall. Today, some things you may not know about a well-known name, L.L. Bean, the man behind the legendary outdoor retail empire. Leon Linwood Bean was born in Greenwood, Maine in 1872, and by his own admission, led a fairly uneventful life until about the age of 40, when he went on a hunting trip. He returned with cold, damp feet and decided if he could devise a more comfortable boot that would protect his feet from the harsh Maine elements. Well, it worked out pretty well. Next year marks the 100th anniversary of the L.L. Bean Company, and here to tell us about the man behind the store is James Witherell. He's a guide and author of the biography L.L. Bean, The Man and His Company, The Complete Story. You can join the conversation. Give us a call at 1-800-399-3566, email to talk@mpbn.net, or reach us on Facebook. Jim Witherell, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And so, first of all, this is an unauthorized biography. What that means is that you did not get cooperation from the company in terms of gathering materials?
That's right. The biggest thing was the photographs that Bean keeps in their archives. I didn't have any trouble finding any information about the company because most of it's out there in one form or another. L.L. Bean himself even wrote a couple of books, if you want to call them books. I think what happened is they ended up very short because he had spent a lot of time writing little kind of word bites for his catalog descriptions. And his get-to-the-point style didn't lend itself very well to writing books.
I would have thought that by now there would have been a lot written about L.L. Bean, given the fame of the company. What sort of inspired you to take up this project?
Basically, the fact that I was born in Rumford and grew up in West Peru, about two towns over from where L.L. Bean was born in Greenwood. And it's just been a lifelong kind of interest and curiosity, and I ended up becoming kind of an outdoorsy kind of person and a master Maine guide, things like that. And so I always thought growing up and even now in my second childhood that it would make a good story. And, of course, there is the fact that their 100th anniversary is coming up next year.
1-800-399-3566. The subject today is L.L. Bean and the biography about the man. Does Greenwood, where he was born, does that exist still?
Contrary to what L.L. Bean wrote in his autobiography, it does. It encompasses the towns of Lock Mills and Howe Hill, where Mount Abram ski area is located. That's where he was born, on Howe Hill in Greenwood, and it does still exist.
No offense to anyone listening in Greenwood right now. L, as we said at the top, L.L. stood for Leon, and then the middle name is spelled, it looks like, Leon Wood,
but
it's not pronounced that way.
I'm not sure of the pronunciation, but there seems to be in the literature and all the research I did, there's some confusion about is it Leon Wood or was his name actually Linwood, Leon Linwood Bean when he was born. And given to the main tendency to pronounce things as we do, it could have been Leon Wood and people would say Leon, the way we say it quickly, and Leon could be heard as Lin if you say it fast enough. Mm-hmm. But by the time he turned 18 on his draft registration, he was much older than that. On his draft registration, it is Leon Wood Bean. His parents called him Lenny, and just a lot of people in Freeport just called him Lynn anyway.
Right, so he never went as LL to anyone who knew him?
No, not to his friends, I don't think. I think the LL Bean was kind of an image thing that he liked to promote, used to promote his business.
His parents both died when he was quite young. He was 12, and they died very close together.
Within 4 days of each other when he was 12. After that, he moved nearby to South Paris, I believe, to stay with his mother's brother. His uncle Benjamin, I believe it is, and it was with one of his cousins the following year that he went on his first deer hunting trip.
And he was an outdoor lover even at that point, or had even discovered the outdoors.
That's right, even at that age. The second year that he went deer hunting, you start to see the beginning of his entrepreneurial spirit when he shot a deer and ran into a couple of other hunters out in the woods who hadn't bagged anything. And he sold his deer to them for $12 and went into town, bought some provisions, and spent another week or so in the woods with his traps and returned home with some pelts that he could sell and most of his $12.
He also briefly sold soap, laundry soap?
When he was working his way through school, a lot of people think that they kind of like to downplay the educational aspect of L.L. Bean's life, saying that he was orphaned and worked his way up. But he was quite intent on going to school. Even at a young age, he moved to Hebron to work on a farm so he could attend Hebron Academy for free. They're not able to find his name in the records, but I've been told by the grandson of the farmer for whom L.L. Bean worked. Getting to the soap story, he went to Kent's Hill Academy, Kent's Hill College, I think it was called back then, in the 1890s. And what he did was he went around to housewives in the area, sold them a certain amount of soap. Then he went to the local grocers around the area, had them purchase that much plus that much more, and finally ended up in Portland, where he sold the distributor buy a whole boxcar load of soap so he could fill future orders. And I guess he made out quite well, and that's how he paid for at least a part of one of his years at Kent's Hill College.
Then from the age of 20, which is really quite a long stretch, we'll talk about this in a moment, but he was not a young, successful entrepreneur. He didn't really get famous until relatively later in life. But from 20 to 40, he had a job as he was a haberdasher, or he worked with his brother.
When he graduated from Kent's Hill, he went to, I believe, Falmouth and worked with one of his brothers in a haberdashery. It wasn't until a couple of years later he ended up in Freeport and even had a little shop in Auburn for a while where he worked. He worked at Mr. Moody's Shoe Store on Main Street in Auburn, where Gritty's Tavern is today.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Right there. His store is now the game room with a couple of pinball machines in it. He figured out that he wasn't making enough money selling shoes for Mr. Moody, so he convinced him to let him set up a little counter where he sold pants that he got from one of his four brothers, and even had a little carriage. Moved back to Freeport in around 1905, and still working in haberdasheries, men's clothing stores, with one or other of his brothers, and didn't even. There was a 20-year interval between the ages of 20 and 40 when his entrepreneurship kind of hibernated.
Sure. Our guest today is Jim Witherell, the author and guide and author of the book L.L. Bean, The Man and His Company, The Complete Story. To join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566 or email at talk@mpbn.net. So, he's 40 years old, finally, and has a personal experience that really changes his life. He goes on a hunting trip, and when he returns, his feet are in rough shape. He doesn't like that and decides to take action.
Right. It was 1911, the fall of 1911, because the process of developing the boot took some time. He returned with his big old flat feet, cold, wet, and sore from the wet leather boots he'd been wearing, the work boots that he used to tromp around the woods, and said, there's got to be a better way. He took down a pair of rubbers that people used to put over their dress shoes and took a pair down off the shelf, fashioned some leather uppers, and sewed them, had a local cobbler sew them together. And he just said, quite innocently, praised them to a local dairy farmer who wore a pair over the winter and said, you know, I think you've got something here. So then there's the story of the first 100 pairs that he sold in 1912, with 90 of them coming back.
Yeah, right.
Most true Mainers know that by heart already. And what happened was the rubbers that he used weren't strong enough to stay attached, stitched to the leather uppers, and the rubber tore away. And, of course, of the 90 boots, pairs of boots that came back, of course, he made full refunds.
And he made good on his very first guarantee,
yeah,
which is a popular story.
Mm-hmm.
But he was in a bit of a predicament at that point, because even though he did live up to the guarantee, he still had to find a way to get money to make more boots and fix the ones that didn't work and do all that.
Right. He had refunded most of the money and still had a product that he couldn't sell, so he borrowed $400 from one of his brothers and made a trip to Boston, where it took some doing to convince the U.S. Rubber Company to make the rubber bottoms specifically for his boot. And he likes to say, even in his autobiography, which he wrote in 1960 at the age of 88, he liked to brag that U.S. Rubber says, I'm still one of their biggest customers.
This to me was a turning point in the book in some ways, in that many other people would have tried this and tried attaching the leather to the rubber boot, and it would rip away. And then they would go to Boston and try to get the product improved, and then he'd reach another barrier. A lot of people would have given up at that point and said, forget it. He doesn't, though. He really believes that he can fix this boot and make it work.
It was such a simple idea. It was one of those, you know, you have a good idea when you figure, well, why hasn't somebody thought of this before? And he just knew it was such a good invention. Instead of tramping around the woods in heavy, wet leather work boots.
So what was it about the boot, though, that he believed in? Obviously, the rubber keeps you protected from the snow and water. But why not just wear rubber boots, and why attach this leather upper?
Probably. I'm not sure exactly what his motivation was, but he liked to say that the leather wouldn't, the rubber bottoms rather, wouldn't draw the feet, you know, that sucking, hot, withery feeling that you have. And the leather uppers must have had some degree of breathability. He was sure that it was a far superior boot to what was out there.
All right. We're going to take a quick break, but as we do, you'll hear a song sent in to us by Stanley Keach. Now, it's titled Boots from L.L. Bean. Stanley's a resident of Rome. And when we come back, your questions and comments about L.L. Bean, send us an email, talk@mpbn.net, post a comment on the MPBN Facebook page, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back.
So you've been to Moody's Diner and Letourneau's Auto Parts and most every major landmark in between. And though you're from away, you fit in most any day when you're wearing your new boots from L.L. Bean. You know what I mean. Boots from L.L. Bean, they go awful good with black or red or green. And you look more like a Mainer than any out-of-stater. In your rubber bottom boots from L.L. Bean.
Governor LePage says he is trying to save MainCare from insolvency. Critics believe his proposed cuts to MainCare are immoral. 3 days of public hearings are underway as lawmakers begin to consider the governor's plan to cut more than $200 million from the program. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Maine Watch this week will be live from the State House to focus on Maine Care. We hope you'll join us.
Join us for Maine Watch live this evening at 8 o'clock on MPBN television. Maine Watch will also be rebroadcast tomorrow evening at 9 on television and tomorrow afternoon at 12:30 here on MPBN Radio.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the National Transportation Safety Board calls for states to ban cell phone use while driving, including hands-free. Efforts to address the dangers of distracted driving.
Join us for the Diane Rehm Show this afternoon at 2 o'clock.
Designer jeans. And though the cost is a dyke high, they are still a good buy. For there is status in these boots from L.L. Bean. So you'd like to catch a deer.
And welcome back. This is MPBN. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, a discussion with Jim Witherell, the author of the unauthorized biography, The Life of L.L. Bean. Join the conversation by giving us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Send an email to talk@mpbn.net or post a comment or question on our Facebook page. Let's go to this is 1912. The boot is sort of in the beginning of its manufacturing life. The company's very young. And then something happens that will really help L.L. Bean to move forward in this endeavor, which is the passage of parcel post. Congress decides to pass this. Why was that a significant moment for L.L. Bean?
I think because he seized upon it right away. And there's some evidence that his competitors were kind of tepid, slow to warm to the idea. But L.L. Bean was right there looking at the charts, the different postal zones and pounds and ounces and what am I going to get out of this? There was one story where he was sitting around his office with some of his cronies who dropped in for their four afternoon howdies, and John Gould entered the office and sees them surrounded by 27 different axes and hatchets. And one of the criteria for the decision about which one to carry in the catalog was its weight and how much would it cost to ship it to Zone 8, which is in Alaska. So he was very quick to jump on that.
You mentioned John Gould, who was young but knew L.L. Bean and had various dealings with him in Freeport. And I read that you quote John Gould as saying that if you dropped into to shake hands with L.L. Bean, you'd get home to find a catalog in your mailbox. So he understood the power of the catalog.
Oh, and of marketing. He was a very astute marketer. He would run ads in, I believe it was Forest and Stream magazine. And one month he would give his address as 35 Main Street. The next month the address would be 23 Main Street in Freeport. And that way he could track which ad generated the response. It didn't matter which address he used because, of course, the post office was right downstairs in his own building until I think it was 1960 or 1962 when it moved up the street about 600 feet.
Yeah. This allowed him, though, to reach a new market places, even into the major cities of New York, for example, where some of these products began to catch on with what were called sports.
A lot of sports, people from away that we Mainers say, the sports, and it's funny how not only did they catch on as far as practical uses for hunting and fishing, the uses for which they're intended, but they also became fashionable. Fashion being cyclical as it is, you would see people in Harvard Square wearing bean boots going to and from class or just shopping or something like that. And Beans actually won some Vogue, I believe it is, fashion awards before the big thing would be the preppy phenomenon started in by Lisa Birnbach's preppy handbook in 1980.
Right. Yeah, that was a big 80s.
Right.
1-800-399-3566. Our guest is Jim Witherell, the author of the biography of L.L. Bean. We're going to take a moment here to talk with a guest on the phone who joins us now. Stuart Keach has a story about meeting L.L. Bean, I believe. Mr. Keach, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here, and I have my story of L.L. Bean goes back to 1939 when I was coming up the coast of Maine with a boat from Edgartown on our way to Eastport. And we came uptown and shopped and went upstairs to the store and came down, and there we were standing, three young men, waiting and looking for a ride. And along came L.L., and he said, "Are you boys looking for a ride?" And he said, "Yes, we are." I said, "Well, hop in." And he got in this lovely black car there, very courtly gentleman, and we drove down to Freeport Harbor, and it was just one of those glorious things that were my experience there. And the other experience that I had dates back after the war with a great friend of his and mine, Alex Della Carter, who was in the fishing and game department there. And Alex carved turkeys for your parties and that kind of thing there. And my wife and I were on our way to New Zealand to fish for the big brown trout there. And Alex said, "Well, I've got something for you that I think you'll enjoy." And lo and behold, he gave me two beautiful pack rods. I don't know where they came from, but we used those pack rods in New Zealand very happily.
Interesting. Now, what were your impressions of L.L. Bean?
Try again.
What were your impressions of him? I know that he was described as a loud person and fairly jovial.
Oh, yes. Your impressions. I can't really remember any conversation going down in the car to Freeport Harbor, except that he was very cordial and very, very courtly. That would be my impression of him there. And then there was one other story that I have that I don't know whether it's true or not, and that was my version of why L.L. Bean is open 365/24/7. Mm-hmm. And this is the way the story came to me, that the insurance inspectors came around and said, "Well, Mr. Bean, you have to have someone here in order to protect the property." And he said, "Oh, fine," and got a watchman. And lo and behold, one night he came through the store, and the watchman was taking a cat nap. And he said, "Oh, I'll solve that problem. I will have you wait on customers." And wait on customers that way, and that's why the school store is open 24/7, 365.
Interesting. Do you remember anything about the store itself? Can you describe what it looked like?
And try again.
I wondered if you could recall anything about how the store looked.
Very, very vividly. I can remember vividly those front stairs there. They were long, right straight up there, and the store was yellow, and the stairs went straight up from the corner. Yes, it was a very, and the store was very simple in the sense that all of the things that you wanted were very near at hand. And I can remember the fishing rod department particularly. It was just great and it was wonderfully convenient. I think that's probably the best word that I could give it.
Convenient. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
That's great. Now, when will this air?
You're actually airing right now. You're live on radio. So.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
And thank you again.
Thank you for calling.
Yeah. You bet.
Have a good day.
Bye-bye.
Stuart Keach, who recalling some experiences with L.L. Bean in 1939. We think today of L.L. Bean's competitors as, you know, Land's End, Eddie Bauer in more recent years. But what struck me was that early on, one of the biggest competition was Abercrombie and Fitch in New York City. David Abercrombie was originally, I guess, a maker of tents and rucksacks. That was his business. And in that 12-story store on 45th Street in New York, they actually also had a rifle range in the basement. So Abercrombie & Fitch was an outdoor retailer, or at least had a large part of its operation as an outdoor.
It was very much like L.L. Bean. On the roof of the building, they had a log cabin and a fly fishing pond. So right in the middle of Manhattan. So they were very much a competitor. In fact, I think they had, unless it was a typo that I came across during my research, their catalog was several hundred pages, something of which L.L. Bean never even dreamed They had ladies wear well before L.L. Bean decided that he needed to outfit the fairer sex. And the only problem with Abercrombie and Fitch is during the preppy boom, I think they tried to go in that direction with the clothing and stuff and kind of lost their core customer or their core values and also over eager expansion had cost them. And of course now it's part of the owned by the Limited or something, which owns Victoria's Secret and it morphed into what it is today.
Not a lot of rucksacks at Abercrombie and Fitch anymore, I guess.
No.
1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation with Jim Witherell. Eddie Bauer, of course, we do know as a competitor. And Eddie Bauer was a real guy who, like L.L. Bean, kind of came about inventing his signature product through a personal experience.
That's right. Indeed, a real person. And in the 20s, I think it was, he was on a steelhead fishing trip and in the rain and almost died from hypothermia and decided to invent create the down-filled coat. And that was the beginning of the Eddie Bauer empire, just as the boot had started L.L. Bean's.
The Great Depression hits the United States in the late 20s, 1929. From what I read in your book, it does not appear that L.L. Bean's operation took a big hit as a result, as many other businesses did.
It weathered the Depression very well. It not only survived, but it thrived during the Depression. In 1934, L.L. Bean, a manufacturer, became L.L. Bean Incorporated, and most of the stock, as it remains today, went to family members, except for, I think, his accountant at the time. But I think what you're referring to is by 1937, that was the first year that L.L. Bean Incorporated reached $1 million in annual sales. And the reason for this is probably simply that L.L. Bean sold the goods people needed to survive. A lot of people would hunt and fish just to put food on the table, and they would buy the necessities, which is what L.L. Bean was selling at the time. So he made out quite well through the Depression.
Yeah. And as you say, the company sold stock for the first time, but it was never made available to the public. Why was that?
That you'd have to ask the board of directors. I think they were just happy with things. They're happy with things the way they are. They like to answer to Main Street, as they say, and not to Wall Street. They've always, even way back when L.L. Bean started, he always financed the operation with his profits as opposed to going into debt, selling stock or getting loans. It's a very, in that respect, it's hard to find out a lot about the company because they don't have to be public if they don't want to. And so we're pretty much every February or March we hear about what their annual sales were last year after all the returns have been processed and what the employees are going to get for a bonus. And that's about it.
Sure. But it's safe to say that by the 30s, L.L. Bean is a household name in America, and yet he doesn't really know that he's famous, I guess. And I'm referring to the story about the surprise visit from the first lady to Freeport.
Right, Eleanor Roosevelt. Just found out that she carried a revolver with her because she didn't like Secret Service protection. But that day, it was early August of 1933, she rolled up in a black convertible with a friend of hers and followed closely by two Secret Service men in another black convertible. And it caused quite a stir. L.L. was reading the newspaper or on the phone or something, and I guess his son tried to tell him, Mrs. Roosevelt is here. Mrs. Who? Roosevelt who? Mrs. FDR, the First Lady. And I guess she had stopped in to look on her way to Campobello Island, and she was trying to find some fishing boots, I think, for her husband. And she ended up not finding any boots, but he gave her a pocket knife to give to the president. And a few days later, he received a nice thank you letter on White House stationery. Big to-do in town, big commotion. L.L. Bean yelled out his window to the chief of police. Here comes Mrs. Roosevelt. Stop traffic, clear the street, see that she gets out of town okay. And it's been written about by three or four different people.
Right. We're going to take another short break. When we return, more of your comments and questions for James Wetherill about his book, L.L. Bean, The Man and His Company, The Complete Story. Stay with us.
Most of the time, I'm living in the moment because I've actually forgotten about yesterday.
How does a family cope when Alzheimer's disease strikes in the prime of life?
I think we're just holding steady. We'll take the card that's been played and make the very best of it, you know?
I'm Deborah Becker. Join me for a special report, Fade to Darkness, The Age of Alzheimer's.
Join us this afternoon at 1 o'clock.
You've got big questions about the economy, the world, raising a family. Hi, I'm Tom Ashbrook, host of On Point. We work hard to shine a light on the way ahead, challenging lawmakers, top business minds, big thinkers, and doers to share ideas that can work. It's fresh perspective you won't hear anywhere else. Join us for the next On Point right here on MPBN Radio.
Join us for On Point. Tonight, the Iraq War and America. After almost 9 years, the troops are nearly home. We'll weigh the war tonight on Point. Join us at midnight.
The best, which you purchased with your boots from L.L. Bean. Now you can't buy boots like these at any other store. Not Bloomingdale's or Rennie's or Filene's.
This is MPBN. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to a new program on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network. We invite you to help us name this new show. Send your suggestions to program producer Jonathan Smith. His email is jpsmith@mpbn.net or post them to our Facebook page. Today, a conversation about L.L. Bean. What do you think of when you think about the man who built the empire out of a waterproof boot? Maybe you visited the store in its early days and have a story to share. Our guest is Jim Wetherill, the author of the book. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. We had a caller earlier who had to leave us but left a question about L.L. Bean trying to sell boots to the U.S. government in the 40s. Jim, are you familiar with that story?
Yes. As a matter of fact, L.L. Bean worked twice for the War Department during the World War II. First, as a cold weather gear expert for the Army, and again later designing products for the Navy. One of his sons, he had two sons who were more or less involved in the business. One more so than the other. Warren, the one who wasn't as involved, was a talented designer and designed a briefcase for a naval officer's training. But the story of the boots that he sold to the government were when they were trying to decide on what kind of a boot that the troops should use. Them Western fellows, as he called them, were mostly young cavalry officers, and they wanted a 16-inch tall boot from the floor to the top of the leather would have been 16 inches. L.L. Bean wanted a 10-inch boot because it would be less restrictive on the legs, not to mention lighter, and save money on elk hide, which was both scarce and expensive. So L.L. Bean, in his unassailable reasoning, said, well, if the average soldier walks 7 miles a day, lifting eight extra ounces every time, that's 18,000 steps or 4,620 pounds that the soldier will be lifting extra every day. So in the end, they compromised and ended up with a 12-inch tall boot.
I wanted to clarify our earlier guest on the phone who was sharing the experience of 1939 of running to L.L. Bean was Stuart Gillespie. Stuart Gillespie, I misidentified him. I apologize for that. 1-800-399-3566. We're talking with Jim Wetherill, the author of L.L. Bean, The Man and His Company. In 1960, Ted Williams, the Red Sox great, tries to buy the company. Why didn't that work out?
I'm not sure exactly why. I'm pretty sure that it's simply as L.L. Bean got older, he really didn't care to change anything. He was happy with the status quo. He was getting kind of, by then he was 88. He was very old. He lived until 1967 and died at the age of 94. But he was just happy to come in and take care of his personal matters and just leave it a sleepy $3 million company. It might have been $2 to $3 million at the time. So he declined Mr. Williams' offer to merge or to sell out completely to him.
Ted Williams did okay, though.
He landed on his feet. About 7 weeks later, he became the head of the Ted Williams Sears Sports Advisory Staff or something like that for Sears, Roebuck & Company. And his annual salary in 1960, remember, was $100,000. So he did okay.
That's good money in 1960.
Yes.
Let's go to Tom in Hiram. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Yeah, hello.
Yes, did you have a comment?
Many years ago now, around 1979, I met an old Native American man here in my town who had, in the past, made axe handles for L.L. Bean, and it struck me that he had this, you know, massively personal relationship with L.L. Bean himself. It's like the man cultivated his suppliers and treated them very, very well. That seemed clear to me. And I had bought the first thing I ever bought was an axe from L.L. Bean, and I brought it in and showed him, and he wasn't positive he'd made it, but we had a very good conversation about his techniques for making axe handles, and I just thought it was very interesting.
Yeah, do you still have that axe today?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. It's right under the seat of my truck. It's my emergency chop through any storm branch I come across kind of axe.
All right, great. Well, thanks for calling.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Let's take another call. Judy is calling from Wilton. Hi, Judy.
Hi. My question was, there's an old story about L.L. Bean talking to his stockbroker on the phone so loudly that people in town would be sure they knew when he was going to call and hang out outside the window to listen. Is that true?
Jim is shaking his head. Yes.
Yes. Yes. I don't know if it's John Gould that wrote about it. I do recount the story in my book that most or half of the adult males in Freeport would come up with some reason to be at the post office, which, as you'll recall, was right down below, was on the first floor of L.L. Bean's building. And they would congregate at exactly the same time that L.L. Bean was talking to his stockbroker. So it led to a very savvy group of investors in Freeport until it started to get cold out and L.L. Bean had to close the window. And then all of the would-be investors were literally out in the cold until spring.
I like that.
Yeah, that's true.
My memories of going down to L.L. Bean, we love to go to the store, but my memories of circle more around across the street. The Falcon restaurant was owned by my great aunt and my cousin, and going in and having Grandma Ruth's apple pie and going to the restaurant across the street back before they had all of the other stores and everything. It was just L.L. Bean, a few other shops, and
the drugstore. Right, the drugstore across the street. People would come looking for work during the Depression, and if L.L. Bean didn't have anything for them, he would send them over to the restaurant and at least buy them a meal.
What year would that have been, Judy?
I'm thinking that Aunt Ruth had the restaurant in the 70s, late 60s, early 70s, but I'm not sure.
I recall the name, the Falcon Restaurant, yeah.
Yeah. And it was there for many, many years, and even after she had passed away and the restaurant had sold, they still sold Grandma Ruth's apple pie, and they used all of her old recipes. But they'd get up at 3 in the morning and go in to start baking and made everything fresh.
Yeah.
And so we'd go eat at the restaurant and then go wander around at L.L. Bean.
Sounds like a good day.
It was.
All right. Thanks, Judy.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Jim, if L.L. Bean's credited with, of course, with inventing this boot and this company, but it was really Leon Gorman who's credited with making L.L. Bean into what it is today. Can you talk a little bit about that?
That's right. It's if it wasn't for Leon Gorman, there probably wouldn't be an L.L. Bean today. When he got out of the Navy in 1960, he went to back to Bowdoin, and his advisor there told him, well, maybe your grandfather has something for you to do. So he went up to Freeport and thought that, well, his advisor must have seen more in the place than he did. As soon as he got there, he had all these great ideas, but he couldn't implement them as long as L.L. Bean and his other son, Carl, ran the place. L.L. Bean died February 5th, 1967, and Carl, unfortunately, he took over, of course, upon L.L. Bean's passing, but he passed away in the middle of October, later that year, 8 months later.
He was not at the helm very long.
Not very long. He had a terminal illness, and he passed away, and this was when Leon Gorman became president and CEO and finally got to implement all of the changes, and it went from $3.5 million in annual sales in 67, so it's 10 million, hundreds of millions, and today it's 1.6 billion or something, and all thanks to Leon Gorman's vision.
Let's go to the phones. Patricia is calling from Camden. Hi, Patricia.
Hi. I'm calling because Linda Bean, there's been a lot of controversy in our area in Mid-Coast Maine, how Linda Bean has bought up the a lot of the community stores in the fishing villages in the Mid-Coast, and they were as iconic as the store, and how she has gentrified them. For instance, they used to be open at 5 in the morning, and now it didn't make business sense, whatever, opening them up later. And I'm just wondering if the author has touched on that maybe, or the other generations of the Bean family.
Right. Thanks, Patricia.
The thing, because my book is more about L.L. Bean and his company, I touch upon Linda Bean only in the passing, when she ran for Congress, I believe it was, in 1988, and again 4 years later in 92. She was very conservative, and it caused some problems for the company. I think a gay group was threatening a boycott and things like that. But I can't really speak to what she's doing today, except when I was doing some final research, I did come across some chat room or something where people wanted to boycott Maine Lobster, and because going way back to her political views in the late 80s and early 90s, and someone else jumped in and said, well, yes, but think of all the good Mainers you'll put out of work.
Yeah. We're going to have to end there. Jim Wetherill, author of the biography, L.L. Bean, The Man and His Company, The Complete Story. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you.
Today's program was produced by Jonathan Smith. John Keimel ran the board. We also had help from Rich Tozier and the MPBN web team. You can listen to this and other new programs by visiting mpbn.net. Click on the radio tab, then click on the call-in program. I'm Keith Shortall. Have a great afternoon.